Welcome everybody again, and we ask everyone to take note of the people and the activities that are mentioned in the newsletter, the bulletin this week, and several need, as John mentioned in the prayer a while ago, need to be in our hearts and thoughts and our prayers, and then also a number of activities, of course, are always around this time of the year. Please keep our elders and our servants, our teachers, in your prayers at all times. I mentioned to you when we started looking through the letter of James at the first of this month, that we, at the first of the past month, that we want to take a letter which speaks to practical issues and do something that we often pray about together, and that is make application of these things to our everyday lives. And we've taken a practical letter which addresses some specific problems or needs in Christian living, and we've been trying to take a look at how the teachings of these passages apply to the place that's dearest in our lives, and that's to our home and to our family. Often these passages look like they say what they always have said, but they look different when you're thinking about how it would apply in our relations with our husbands or wives or our parents or children or our brothers and sisters. This text that we're going to look into tonight is definitely a paragraph like that. It's a rather intimidating passage. It seems to have a mood about it, which is not a happy one when you first look at it. And yet, closer examination reveals that this is talking about relationship. Now, in this case, the relationship between God and His people, and the relationship between God and His people who are at odds with Him in some ways, and who are having quarrels and fusses with each other. But the solutions to the problem would apply to any other relationship in our lives which involves persons, and definitely to our families and our dealings with our families. What happens when we get crossways with people we love? Faith makes good people, but it doesn't make people who never get crossways with those they love. One of the things that will determine whether we are successful in our families will be how we respond when there is conflict, whether we can handle that in a healthy way. There have been all kinds of materials written by counselors who specialize in these fields that the people can consult when they're working through conflict, and they have all these things not to do and then all these things to do. But all of them will, in one way or another, involve variations on what James 4, verses 1 through 10 teaches us. And I want to try to call our attention to that tonight. Please notice with me to start with that this is a text which starts out addressing relational pain. Pain and relationship, trouble and problem and relationship, which causes people to hurt. And to hurt badly. There's nothing that hurts quite as bad as conflict in the close relationships in our lives. And without digging into every phrase, you can just begin to glance down through it and see what I mean by this. Verses 1 and 2 mentions the quarrels and fights that are among these readers, these beloved brothers, as James has been calling them through this letter. The personal passions or desires or pleasures that we made reference to this morning from James 1 show up here, only they're not being handled well here. And the result is the experience of fusses and fights, conflicts and quarrels, pain and hurt in the lives of these people. The words are used as if these are ongoing activities. I'm going to ask us to think about what happens when we decide we're going to quit those activities. Notice that in real life, this is creating a situation where the readers desire but do not have. In other words, they have needs in their lives that are going unfulfilled. There is a dissatisfaction and an emptiness in their relationship toward each other. That'd be bad enough if we're talking about God's people to Him. It's also bad if it's us to each other in our home settings, where we know that something is missing, we're not getting out of it, none of us, what we need to get from it or what God meant for us to get from it. And if you put those two together, the quarrels and fights, and then the wanting but not having part of it, you begin to see pain in relationship. And then that comes out to a circumstance where James finally says, the people are like adulteresses, verse 4, who have become enemies of God by their friendship with that which is opposite His nature. The New English Bible translates this, you are false, unfaithful, and then enemies of God. This is God's people who are overcome by conflicts that are not addressed and are unresolved. When a person's worst enemies are his own household, then that's hurt there, and that's a painful situation. When those who are supposed to be one's friends are not dependable and are unfaithful and admire the enemy more than they do the ones they're intended to love, then you see the painful situation. Can a family survive that? Well, Christians believe yes, if it's dealt with. And if it's dealt with in a healthy way, and if the individuals and relationships can get well again, we believe people can get well again. Now, there's a crucial hinge in this that occurs right here. Between what we've just said and where we're headed at the end of this study tonight, in this circumstance where there is relational pain, there are still persons who value the relationship. This is crucial. Whether the relational value is still existent, whether it's caught before people decide, this is no use, I'm not willing to invest any more of myself in this. You look in the situation here, and please notice in verses 5 and 6 that even though God sees the people at this time as His enemies by their friendship of the world, He still cares about them. Verse 5 says, He yearns jealousy over the Spirit that He's made to dwell in us. In other words, He cares about His people. He still values them. He still wants them. He wants it to be right between them. And here is maybe the crucial moment in family relationships. It's one thing to know that there's pain here. The question is, do we still value the persons? And this relationship with them still something that we believe to be worth what it takes? We're here tonight singing praises to God and trying to encourage each other because he felt like it was worth it. There are families sitting around you too who you don't know the problems they have encountered and they have overcome faithfully in their lives. It is possible to get well again if the relationship is valued, whether it's between a child and dad or mom or a husband and wife toward each other or parents toward a child. It's still, the question is, well, First thing, do you value the relationship? Secondly, are you willing to extend grace within that relationship? Here is God's yes answer to those over whom He yearns with all the zeal of a great and good God. Verse 6, therefore, He gives more grace. Therefore, it says, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. What does it mean to give grace? It means to offer toward someone that which is not deserved by that someone. To extend a kindness that is something greater than simply responding in kind to how you've been treated. It's the generosity of spirit which offers something which the other person needs but does not deserve. And in family relationships, this is what allows us to accept each other when we know everything about each other and still decide that we care enough to put up with each other, but we care too much to just put up with each other. We're going to make something more of a blessing out of our walk through life than that. We're going to try to resolve the conflict that's inevitable in human relationships in a way that's good for both of us or all of us. Now, this is where the biblical approach to this gets past somebody's counseling and just says, in relationships between persons, there are certain things that have to be done in order for you to get well where there's been hurt. And they're as obvious as the nose on even my face, if you really stop and think about them. They're just practical things that have to happen if you're going to relate to each other. And they're mentioned in verses 7 through 10. We've read these before in a different light. I'm asking us just to think about them as the practical things that are done in relationships which have been troubled but are going to be made whole again. Number one, where James says, submit yourselves therefore to God, I'm going to say, but we're not gods. So submit to what the relationship needs. Here's the relational healing, verse 7 to start with. Submit to what the relationship needs. Now think of how scriptural this is for a moment. In Ephesians 5, verses 18 and following, Paul is talking about what it means to be people who are filled with the Spirit. And after he's talked about walking in wisdom and talks about not being drunk but being filled with the Spirit and then singing and teaching and admonishing, then he says, submitting to one another in the fear of Christ, Ephesians 5:21. And then he says, wives, be subject to your own husbands. Husbands, love your wife enough to offer yourself in her best interest like Christ did for the church. That, friends, is a high calling. To submit to what the relationship needs, not to what you want, not to what the other person thinks at that moment, but to what the relationship needs. I ran across something in some kind of an old magazine written by a lady who talked about something her dad did that turned her life around. She was a young newlywed, and she and her husband were struggling with marital issues that got so exasperating they just seemed too huge to her to overcome. Even though she says when she writes this, it turns out they really weren't. So she said when she got to the end of her rope, she called her dad for help, a person whom she respected and admired. And She explained to her dad what they were going through, and it was a place where there was disagreement. It wasn't morally right or wrong or anything. She told him what it was, and she says, "My wise father then said 13 words that changed my life. Here they are. Do you want to be right, or do you want to be happy?" James is saying here, if you're tired of the quarrels and fights, of wanting and not having, and of being false friends and faithless enemies, submit to what the relationship needs. If it's a marriage, we always tell people, treat it like there is this big box and it's empty, and you have to put into it what you want to get out of it. Submit to the needs of the relationship. Secondly, James tells us, resist any threat. Put up a fight instead to any threat to that relationship. If you are submitting to the relationship, and if it's what really matters to you, and if it depends on giving up rooting for something else, although you already can tell if you're really submitting to the relationship, you don't make that kind of things like that. What would be more important? If she said to you, I just can't stay with you if you're going to root for the Dallas Cowboys. What would you think? Now, you wouldn't, don't marry somebody if you're going to make that kind of conditions, but you see what I mean? James says here, submit yourselves therefore to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Now, we're not talking about submitting necessarily to God here, but to what the relationship needs. And we're not talking about resisting just the devil. We're talking about that which is a threat to your family. Run from it. It's not worth it. Third, draw near to the one love. James says, draw near to God, and he'll draw near to you. Somebody has to go first. But when you've been hurt, don't run from each other. Run from what caused the hurt toward each other. And when somebody in your family makes a move toward you, don't stand back like you almost have to be forced to acknowledge them. Draw near to them too. This is a funny thing when you get to thinking about it. I ran across a quote attributed to a radio host whose name is Celeste Headlee. I don't know or never heard her program, but she says, "We must learn to talk to people we disagree with because you can't unfriend everyone in real life." Especially if they're in your family. They're going to show up at Thanksgiving and Christmas and stuff like that. So learn to draw near to them. And then James continues the practical parts of this. Make your hands clean. Cleanse your hands, he says, you sinners. You can see that he's not talking about just using good hygiene practices in terms of washing your hands. He's talking about, listen, if you've been doing something which has brought injury to the relationship and pain to the people you love, quit doing it. Change the action that is there. You have a choice about that. If you know it's hurting people that come first in your life, quit doing it. And that's a, I don't know how it would be more. I admit that's hard to to apply to ourselves, but I don't know how James could be more straightforward than he's being right there. There's no way to argue with him. If you know it's causing hurt to people you love, and if you're going to draw near to them, then quit doing it. Fifth here, he says, see that your motives are pure. He says, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. And you remember, this double-minded business is something we keep running up against in James. This is about the third time. It means to try to be two persons in one body, to try to be headed in two different directions at once, to try to swim in the Atlantic and the Pacific at the same time. It can't be done. You have to decide. So not double-minded. Not quitting doing something while you're in the presence of the family, but having it in your heart. The picture that I would get of this, it would be the little one made to sit in the think about it chair, who would insist, you could make me sit in the think about it chair, but you can't make me want to do what you're asking me to do, that kind of thing. As boys growing up with my brothers, we'd run across this fairly often where we'd be forced to do something we didn't want to do, but we'd manage to project an attitude which would say, you can make me do it, but you can't make me like it. That's being double-minded. And where that goes on, it's an expression of immaturity. So James is more than moving us toward real intimacy with people in our family, people that we love. He is saying you have to get to the place where you value that relationship enough where you're not pretending and you're not trying to leave an impression just to manipulate that person in your family. Then we take a big step right here. Own the hurt that is present. I don't mean just try to make yourself seem as miserable or as guilty as you can. But James says, be wretched and mourn and weep, verse 9. I think unless we keep this in its context, its setting, we're going to leave the wrong impression about the entire spirit of Christianity. There are people who think Christians are supposed to walk around being wretched and mourning and weeping all the time. That's not what James is saying. He is saying when you know you've hurt people you love, and you know you've sinned against love, then take responsibility for it. Don't say, I'm sorry if you were offended. I'm sorry that you didn't like that. I'm sorry that you don't say something that makes it look like it's that person's fault, that person was hurt by something you said or did. Own it. You sinned against love. That needs to matter. I have something with me that Gene Vincent, who was the preacher for a number of years for the Edmond Church of Christ in the Edmond, and was a teacher in Bible and ministry at Oklahoma Christian. And it was maybe the 49th or 50th anniversary for him and his wife. And he wrote, he said this is what preachers do. They take even their anniversaries and make sermons out of them. He wrote a piece about it, some of the things that he and his wife had learned. And this is number 5. He had 6 things on his list. Number 5 here. We've learned that it's bad if you make the one sad whom you should expect to make glad. And notice he just says it's bad. And what James is telling us here is be the kind of person who is hurt to find out that you've hurt the person that gives most of himself or herself to you in your whole life. And then the next step, show that that matters deeply to you. You can't do it by walking around looking miserable and all of that. But what James says is, let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. And I think he's getting at something that's quite practical here. Remember we talked about in communicating with the people you love, if the tone of voice and the body language and the facial expression and the behavior doesn't correspond with the message, then it's confusing to people. If your family has been in enough pain over what's been going on that it's actually caused conflict, quarrel, emptiness, and animosity in your family, and you find that out and you own it, but then you still think that you should just party, that the main thing is for you to be having a good time, that you can't figure out why that bothered anybody, that you intend for you just to go on like nothing ever happened, then that is not going to be healing. James is telling us something very real. It's simply that if you know you've hurt, if you know it's brought hurt, you have to value the relationship enough to see your part in that, to be sorry enough over it that it actually changes your demeanor in that way. And then, very importantly, James doesn't leave it there. He says, and this is my paraphrase, depend on the grace of the other person. You've shown grace by valuing a relationship and submitting yourself to it in repentance. Now depend on that grace. You can't say to the other person, I said I was sorry, now you owe me. What you're doing is humbling yourself and asking the other person to be like God to you in that situation. Now, not everybody does. But everybody who gets well and has a whole relationship does. James says, humble yourselves before the Lord, and He will exalt you. That's what I'm saying here when I mention depending on grace. One of the greatest blessings that the church could offer the world would be relationships that are whole and well in our families. We are not immune as Christians to the hurts that go on everywhere else in the world. We still have those kind of pains in our families. I ask us to take another look at James 4, verses 7 through 10, and to think about what relationship means in real life in these ways. Here's Brother Vinzant again. This is three on his list. He says, three, we've learned. Short lessons from long marriage, he says. Three, that God gives new mercies and new graces every day. That's right, from Lamentations 3, verses 22 through 23. A home can scarcely bear the weight of yesterday's disagreements, misunderstandings, and hurt feelings stored in the attic for quick recycling and reuse. You're not well until you've gotten over it. And not just stored it in the attic, as he said, but got it out of the house. And that's what the grace of God and the forgiveness in Christ makes possible. This is only asking us to treat each other like God treats us. Let him treat you that way. If you're needing to rely on his grace, if you need to become someone who possesses what God offers in his Son, if you're someone who needs the prayers and support of people here who love you, then you let us know that while we stand and, here and sing this song with Elijah together.